You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 151 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. We temporarily have a live studio audience. It's Mrs. Fantasy Genius, who is actually going to come up in the notes in a second here. So she'll be able to woohoo again for herself. We start this week. Let's get to our beer here.
Oh. So we are drinking here today. I thought you were going to mention what episode it was.
Well, I was going to toast to that.
Okay. We have from our good friends at Two Beers Brewing Company, the Sun Chaser IPA, an IPA with orange peel and hibiscus.
Appropriate for this beautiful sunny day in Seattle. Not quite as warm as it was last week, but still springy nonetheless. Positive
spring. Do you want me to read about it, or do we get the gist?
I think we probably got the gist.
All right.
Okay.
I just wanted to say hibiscus again.
I don't know if you pronounced that correctly. I don't know if the H is silent in that, it's definitely something we were debating. I was debating in my head, I guess, is what I'm thinking here.
It's very red. You can see the hibiscus.
Certainly can. Very hibiscus-y. Okay, we start with a toast to Ichiro. Because appropriately, this is the Ichiro episode of the Pelton Cast, along with the Randy Johnson and Lofa Tatupu episode.
And Bruce Irvin.
Yeah.
I was saying
number of top 51s in Seattle sports history. That's like not a common number.
Episode 151. Straight with no chaser, like we do it on the South Side.
There you go. There you go. Anyway, after the Mariners two-game series in Japan last week, more on that in M's Hot Takes later. Ichiro.
Drink it down, people.
Unexpectedly announcing his retirement, left the field in the eighth inning as a defensive replacement to an enormous standing ovation from the crowd at the Tokyo Dome. Ken Griffey Jr. was there on hand to hug him. Two Mariners legends, both of whom probably played well past where they should have.
Straight through the ivy in the outfield, never to be seen again.
It's unclear what exactly Ichiro is going to do now that he's not playing baseball. I hope he finds something to do. On a more somber note, though, we also have to pour one out for Yusuf Nurkic.
Ugh, Nurk.
Who suffered a horrific compound fracture of the tibia and fibula in his left leg in double overtime of last night's Blazers playoff clinching win over the Brooklyn Nets. A somber mood even after the Blazers got that win because of they knew how badly Nurkic was injured.
Horrifying injury. You won't let us talk about basketball until the playoffs start.
I'll let us talk about basketball.
Right now?
Yeah.
Of all times?
Yeah.
What? Okay. I'm thrown off here a little bit. I'm not prepared.
I mean, here's the thing I think we need to know. Like, when they became your Blazers,
mm-hmm.
when you adopted them, you adopted all of the Blazers, and that includes their
UAB.
Track record. Kamloops.
I knew Kamloops was coming up in this podcast.
Yeah, it's been a while.
151, baby.
Since we worked WHL geography into the pod. But that includes the terrible track record of devastating injuries to Blazers centers. Bill Walton, Sam Bowie, Greg Oden. The list goes on, and now
wow, that's a lot of
it includes
draft
Yusuf
busts.
Nurkic. Well,
Bill Walton wasn't.
Well, yeah, he's not a draft bust. He did lead them to a championship.
Horrifying injuries to Blazers big men, though.
It's a long-running trend. And, of course, not just big men. Brandon Roy, UW alum, also stricken down in the prime of his career by his knee injuries.
Okay, so before this, we were riding high, right? By we, I mean Blazers fans like myself.
Yes.
The Blazers were having this excellent season, have basically maintained. I've got a lot of takes here. And first off, the first take is that everybody is talking about breaking up Dame and CJ.
Constantly.
It's the only thing that people talk about. But still, they just keep riding, right? The Blazers just keep winning.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that they like continually are getting better. But
people are trying to fix a problem that doesn't exist. And let me ask you, if this was next season, right? Let's say that there a bunch of transactions happen this offseason. Let's say KD goes to the Eastern Conference. Like, how open is the West for the Blazers then, if this is the same team?
I mean, they're still, I think, a second-tier contender in terms of their point differential. You know, Denver clearly better, although we have to see how that translates
Your
in the playoffs.
A second-tier contender?
The Jazz have been much better in terms of point differential, even though...
The Jazz scare me.
As they should.
This season, it felt like the last 2 weeks
And the Warriors,
so,
of course, would still be very good even without Kevin Durant, probably.
So CJ goes down injury. The Blazers are unaffected, right?
They have... I mean, unaffected is too strong. They did need to go to double overtime against Brooklyn at home, and I don't think that probably would have been the case, even though Seth Curry played well, had CJ been active.
Okay, maybe not unaffected, but they're not devastated by
They've
it,
survived
right?
it, because we Damian have, Lillard has been so great.
We have that couple... And really, as a distributor also, just like Dame playing full court basketball right now, playing excellent.
He was only using 3/4 of the court before.
I'm saying Dame is doing it all.
Yes, it's carrying a huge load.
It's Dame 360. That coupled with the Thunder, I don't want to say collapse, but slide, right? You
know, slide is fair.
We are riding high basketball-wise going into the playoffs.
And then
boom! Down goes Nurk and double overtime. It just felt like the entire bubble was burst.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, it would have been a sad thing even if it had happened, you know, say to a player who was not part of the rotation. Like, you're always going to be devastated to see one of your teammates get so severely injured. But I think part of the somber reaction from the Blazers was also realizing what a huge hit their chances in the playoffs were.
I felt like you could see Terry Stotts kind of like doing the math. He was taking stock of the situation. Like, you could see, because we were too, and we're not the coach of the Blazers, of like...
I mean, I think that leads us to do the math a little bit more.
Because we don't know Yusuf personally.
And also because of the fact that we're not going back out there trying to win a basketball game, which was weird.
But it just felt like he was taking stock of like, okay, what now?
Yeah, and if his stock is anything like my analysis, I wrote about this in an ESPN Plus piece. It's not great.
How crass of you. Dancing on Nurk's grave. You couldn't give him a day.
You know.
So how much worse are the Blazers?
I mean, the problem is they're worse at both ends. I think Enes Kanter will probably start at least for the time being. And, you know, obviously in a larger role, he's going to be more exposed in the pick and roll, particularly in the playoffs. I think teams are really going to target him. And, you know, all the tracking data we have backs up the eye test on, you know, Kanter's difficulty defending in the pick and roll. But then offensively, you know, the Blazers are really relying on Nurkic as a playmaker when teams trap Damian Lillard, as they frequently do after the success the Pelicans had with it in last year's playoffs. And... Yeah, you know, one of the things I found is that teams tend to trap Lillard a lot more when Kanter screens for him rather than Nurkic.
Interesting.
Because he just doesn't have that playmaking ability that Nurkic has, you know, kind of leading the 4-on-3 when two players are on the ball on Lillard. So, you know, Kanter does bring some other skills. He's maybe a slightly better offensive rebounder than Nurkic. Maybe a tiny bit better finisher, but it's a pretty big drop off. And I think that, you know, eventually they're probably going to have to go to Zach Collins.
I was going
to
say, what about Zach Collins?
Yeah. I mean, you know, they clearly prefer to play him at power forward rather than center. So he's not, you know, defending the behemoth opponents that you occasionally face, but, you know, he gives you that stretch element as a stretch five, and also is better and more versatile defender.
Okay.
So, but I mean, I think the concern is like, you play the Jazz in the playoffs, they're at least going to have the two best centers in that series, and Rudy Gobert and then Derek Favors playing as a backup center, and then might even have the third best with Epe Udo.
Oh, God. Is that the worst possible matchup for the Blazers in the first round of the playoffs?
I think it's a worse matchup for them than the Clippers, even though the Clippers are playing so well right now.
Okay, well, we're cheering for the Clippers then.
I mean, San Antonio and OKC may be potentially in the mix, but less likely, I think, at this point.
It was devastating. I hate when that happens. And you're just like, all right, well. I mean, like, realistically, the Blazers weren't contending for a championship this year. I understand that. But it was like the possibility of a deep playoff run was just, like, gone. In that moment.
Pretty much, yeah.
All right, well, get well soon, big man.
Absolutely. But this is what you get when you get the Blazers because of the fact that the Sonics do not exist.
I didn't choose this.
I'm just saying.
Who are you blaming? Do I need to talk about David Stern more? Do we have to bring up that Howard Schultz conversation again? Like, what are you looking for here?
I don't know what I'm looking for here.
I didn't ask for the Blazers to be my team. This was the hand that was dealt me.
Yes. Yes, that is
true. I'm wearing a Sonics Kevin Durant shirt right now. We're both wearing Sonics clothing right now.
Wait, are we?
That's not a Sean Kemp shirt under there?
Oh, yeah. I guess underneath I am. Wearing a t-shirt, yeah. The hoodie is not. Should we do an update on our NCAA tournament pools?
All right.
So sadly, Mrs. Fantasy Genius has left for this. But on the men's side, J44 leads with 560 points, having gone a perfect 16 for 16 on Sweet 16. I'm tied for ninth with Mrs. Fantasy Genius. And you, Tristan, are tied for 32nd and have lost one of your final four teams in Kansas, despite all the chalk the last weekend. On the women's side...
Wait, do we know who J44 is?
Yeah, it's my friend Jana.
Who?
Jana? Yeah.
Got a perfect Sweet 16?
Yeah.
The worst thing about this is talking to our mom about it, because she just keeps talking about how we don't know a single person who's in the bracket. And I was like, after the first day, I was like, yeah, there's somebody who went, I think Mike went like near perfect on the first day, or maybe perfect. And she was like, just another person, we don't know who it is. And I was like, we know most of these people who are involved.
You just don't know them.
Yeah. I was like, it's not like our immediate family.
In the women's pool, loyal listener Noah Cohen, I'm sure that's him, leads the way with 550 points, followed by third Pelton brother Natalie Weiner with 530. I'm tied for seventh with a semi-distant 490. Although the wide variety of champion picks on the women's side this year, like all four one seeds are represented, I think, and maybe even some two seeds. Well, certainly some two seeds because UConn's in there. It means this pool will likely go all the way to the championship game, which is a nice departure from years past.
I mean, it's obviously a lot of Dukes in the men's bracket.
Yes. A lot of people, like myself, sweating out their Nero victory over Central Florida in Taco Fall. You did not submit a bracket for the women's tournament on time. It's a real disappointment.
I thought it started on the following week.
The following week?
I don't know.
If only there was someone you could talk to about who knows these things.
I think I did ask you.
All right, it's time to get to something we've been really excited to talk about. We've had a lot of fun with the ramen bracket. We've had a lot of fun with our past brackets for burgers, dumplings, burritos/tacos. This is number 5 for us. It is time to kick off our search for Seattle's best hot dog/sandwich.
No,
just
God.
Sandwich. Just sandwich. And so we originally advertised that we were going to do that with Ferrale, which was reopening last week with an event at Bar Ciudad in South Park,
Georgetown.
But that turned out to be way too popular of an event. I drove down there, and it was impossible to find a parking spot. There was an enormous line that
The line
see.
Was wicked long.
People were posting on Instagram that they waited over 3 hours to get their sandwich.
Yeah. 3 hours?
3 hours. Wow. Ferrale is very good. It is not worth a three-hour wait. But
I don't know if any food is worth a three-hour wait.
I mean, I'm sure people were just hanging out there and drinking because it was at a bar and they were there with their friends.
Still 3 hours?
I was
hours?
There by myself and trying to watch the NCAA tournament. Could not manage that.
Man, if you're considering the alternative cost of every meal that you're having, you're not waiting for 3 hours for Ferrale.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with that.
Because you could have gotten a sandwich that was near as good. Like, you could have gone to Hitchcock Deli right around the corner, probably for a lot faster than 3 hours.
But the experience, it was a hang.
All right.
Like, there was live music. Like, people were going there to hang out.
Oh, I love live music.
So, there was a lot of standing, but you were going to be there either way, I think. Anyway, so instead we decided to start with two of the favorites, I would say, in this competition. Two fixtures of the Seattle sandwich scene who happen in Capitol Hill to be separated. They're on the same block in Capitol Hill, such that I could go to both of them earlier today for lunch.
And you did. You ate sandwich after sandwich. Bang, bang. Two in a row. It was an impressive feat.
So those are, of course, we started at Honey Hole Sandwiches and then I continued on at the Other Coast Cafe. You bowed out after that, having been to the Other Coast last week.
I mean, I continued on with you.
You did, but
I made the walk. You didn't eat. Let's start by talking about Honey Hole because we went there first. Okay. Actually, I want to talk about both of these kind of in general terms, because to me, when we've talked about the best sandwich in Seattle, the real debate has been between these two sandwich places.
I mean, so here's my thought. If you want to be the best sandwich in Seattle, first off, of those two, you have to be the best sandwich on your block. Which, of course, this is not the original Other Coast Cafe location. That's the one in Ballard. It's not even the one I've been to most frequently, because there was once one downtown. So this was...
And they closed the one downtown?
Yeah.
Huh.
This was a fixture for us at lunch in the Sonics and Storm offices. And I went for the first time in Ballard either late summer of 2006, I know it was the summer, or early summer of 2007. And I wasn't appraised of what I was supposed to order there.
Mm.
And I think I got a chicken parm, which I don't even think is on the menu anymore. I'm not sure. And I was like, okay, this is fine, but it's nothing special. And it was only the second time that we went back and I got the Ragin', was appraised to get the Ragin' Cajun, that I suddenly realized that the Other Coast Cafe has Seattle's best sandwich.
Wow.
Before actively searching to confirm that.
Okay, just watch the takes here.
So when the Sonics, when we moved our offices downtown, we were able to walk to this location via an underground tunnel. It was very convenient during the winter. And we went at least once a month, maybe once every couple weeks.
Once a month is not that frequently. Okay.
No. Back in those days, the menu listed basically like a 7-inch was a half and the 14-inch sandwich was the full.
Okay.
And obviously we were going with the full 14-inch.
100%.
And I was putting that full thing down every time.
That's a lot of sandwich.
It is an amazing amount of sandwich.
So what do they do now? The now base one is the 7-inch.
And then they say if you're extremely hungry or want to share.
If you're an animal who's able to eat two consecutive large sandwiches, feel free to get the giant one.
So there was no concern for me about eating the two sandwiches back to back, because that was the equivalent of what I'm doing.
Oh God,
normally.
So much food.
Since I only went with the 7-incher this time. But so I think that experience at the Other Coast kind of informs my Honey Hole take. You have been very regularly trying to convince me to go there.
Is this your first time going to Honey Hole?
No, I went once. And I'm like, why would I go there when I can just go to Other Coast down the street now that it's open in Capitol Hill? And they also have a third location in Queen Anne. I've actually never been to the Queen Anne one.
That's the one that's now my home, Other Coast.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if I necessarily agree is fair either way, because you should have tried it no matter what. Just because there's another coast there doesn't mean that you shouldn't have tried their sandwiches.
In hindsight, I should have gone with this play of having both before. That was the mistake.
You're a sick human being.
All right, talk about Honey Hole, your Honey Hole
okay,
experience.
Well, so I want to say about my experience. So when I started at the Billions Corporation at the Paramount Theater, before we had a tradition, which was basically payday lunch, right? And most often, the only time that we would go out to eat lunch, to go get it in the world, would be on payday every two Fridays, every other Friday.
You would eat lunch just in the office.
They didn't let us eat lunch.
Oh, no.
Every other Friday, we would go and go get just whatever, right? Go get lunch somewhere. The tradition, however, started, this was before my time there, as payday sandwiches. And that payday sandwich was the Ragin' Cajun at the Other Coast.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
By the time I had gotten there, the tradition had been lost to the sands of time. Well, it was no longer payday sandwiches.
If we don't have traditions, what do we have?
It was just, we would debate the location for hours, mm-hmm. right? So one time, deep into my time being there, this was last spring, we decided to finally go back to the Other Coast for a traditional payday sandwich. And I hadn't had a Ragin' Cajun since maybe calendar year 2008.
That long, even though I'd been continually telling you how much I loved the Ragin' Cajun.
Well, so I went with you one time, I think maybe while I was working at the Storm. And I think I might have been a little bit put off by the price of, like, because it's
expensive. It's, I think, $11.25 for the 7-inch sandwich.
Which, I mean, at the time, it seemed like a lot more money to me in 2008 than it does now.
I mean, it probably wasn't that high back then either. But I have previously declared, like, when they raised the prices at the other customer, I was like, look, they can charge any amount for this sandwich. Oh, don't listen to that other customer. Other people won't pay any amount, but I would.
It's going to be variable pricing for you. But so I hadn't been, because I went one time with you, and I remember not liking it that much.
And so this often happens. So one time the cousin Katie and I went there.
But I got the Raging Cajun.
You did. The famous cousin Katie and I went there because of the fact that we were trying to go to Paseo, but I think it was randomly closed or something. And instead we went to Other Coast. And Katie did not order the Raging Cajun, despite my plea to her. Because after I went the first time and was naive and didn't get it, I have made it my mission to educate everyone that they get the Raging Cajun when they go there.
It's your duty to society to do
that. Or, by the way, if you really are into spicy foods, the Detonator is the even spicier version of the Raging Cajun.
Oh, really?
I think Third Pelton brother Nate pointed out on our Instagram.
The Detonator.
Yeah.
Hello.
I don't think I'd even taken notice of that. It looks a little too hot for me.
As the Raging Cajun, but just a little bit spicier.
It's got like habanero.
Habanero. Perfect.
Hibiscus.
When I went there, I didn't like spicy food in 2008. Like, I didn't start liking spicy food until after that. So it probably was too much for me to handle in 2008.
You know, just some of us with a more refined palate than I'm capable of handling spice.
Well, it's funny to imagine you being more able to handle spice than me.
It really is. It really is.
So we went back this last spring, a year ago.
Yes.
And I had the Raging Cajun again.
And the scales fell off your eyes and they were open to the greatness of the Raging Cajun.
It was one of those moments where you take a bite and it's like eating gold. Right? I'm like, what have I been missing for these last 10 years by not eating the sandwich?
Yeah.
Literally wasting my life for 10 years. And since then, I've been awakened. Right? And that's to me why I think going into this competition, this and Honey Hole were the two favorites going in. They have the belt right now. And there are going to be a lot of competitors coming at them.
At least in the deli sandwich category. Because the chicken sandwiches we've talked about, kind of a category of their own in some ways.
Yeah, well, we should kind of talk about how we're going to structure this. It's not a bracket, but the search.
I mean, we're still deciding how we're going to structure this.
We're coming up with complicated spreadsheets. There are extensive talks.
I'm doing some regression analysis.
yes.
I mean, I think
do that for Taco Time.
Yeah, I know, of course. Well, I think one plan is to have like subcategories and then have the champions of those subcategories face off against each other in the final.
I want to crown a champion for each region, basically. Like,
unclear how many different subcategories there will be.
We're talking hundreds of regions. Hot dog region, hot dog region, Pop-Tart region. But I want to have Seattle's... This is the time where we're going to crown Seattle's best chicken sandwich as well as Seattle's best sandwich.
But then, Seattle's best sandwich overall.
So it could be a chicken sandwich. But right now, we're not just going to crown Seattle's best sandwich. We're going to crown Seattle's best chicken sandwich, Seattle's best hot deli sandwich, Seattle's best cold deli sandwich, Seattle's best other sandwich.
All of these places will be able to hang the best of Pelton Cast best of,
yes.
Much like the Evening Magazine
yes.
Best of Western Washington.
Yes. You and I collectively make one John Curley.
No, we don't. We can't measure up even together to John Curley. It's great.
Anyway, the Other Coast and Honey Hole. So.
All right, we haven't talked about Honey Hole at all.
Your second ever time at Honey Hole.
So the first time I went there, I feel like I may have gotten the gooch because of the fact that sounds familiar, but I also may have gotten one of the pulled pork sandwiches, like the Buford Justice, possibly.
Buford T. Justice.
Put some respect on that name. And I was underwhelmed.
Okay.
I was not actively seeking to go back to Honey Hole.
Wow.
So today, at your recommendation, I got your favorite thing on the menu, which is the Chaka's favorite, formerly the Chachi's favorite, possibly renamed for legal reasons. It seems like
who is suing here? Chachi?
Yeah. Maybe Jody.
Okay.
So this is the sandwich you recommended. Tell me a little bit about why it is your favorite.
I don't know.
Well, you okay? Why do you like honey hole in general? Because we haven't really gone into that.
It's a hot turkey sandwich, yes. Right? So both similar to kind of the other coast, both are coming on kind of a crunchy baguette. This is like a spiced turkey sandwich. The turkey is very flavorful. You didn't feel like the turkey was flavorful?
No, I thought the turkey was very bland.
Wow.
Huh.
So you've got turkey, and to me, this is not like. Honey hole, their turkey is like a sliced deli turkey. This is like the day after Thanksgiving turkey that you're eating.
You mean the other coast? There's the sliced.
There's a bird in the back at Honey Hole.
I hope there's not actually a bird in the back. I don't want that. But yes.
It's real turkey, and it's something that you don't get that much, right? It's not shaved off a loaf. This is real turkey.
Gonna need some dark meat in there if you're doing real turkey.
But you understand the difference.
I do understand the difference, yes.
You know the difference between real turkey and deli meat turkey.
Yeah, the deli meat turkey tasted way better because it's Cajun spiced deli turkey.
You have got to chill on these takes. Wow. They're one of these items may have been better than the other item. I'm willing to accept. But the turkey was not the reason.
It was a factor. I mean, the best thing I can say about this, that is a large amount of turkey they're giving you. Like, it was spilling off the sandwich.
It's almost too much. You're able to be honest.
Too much?
Yeah.
Wow. Imagine what Ben B will think when he hears this.
So you've got turkey, cheese, tomatoes, which of course you picked off because you're a child, and then also like peppercini with their homemade ranch.
A little too dilly for me.
Too dilly?
Yeah, not a big dill guy.
Wow. Homemade ranch. To me, okay, so I guess getting into the sandwich, there are moments, and granted, this is the good thing about sandwiches, is they're not the same every time, right? This is not a manufactured thing. People are back there making them. I feel like the honey hole sandwich at its heights can reach a very high height. When you get turkey that's like really like moist and gooey, if the bread is a little bit softer instead of crunchy, if you have the right amount of ranch on
I like the bread crunchy. The bread was strong. I had no complaints there.
I'm saying that it is an excellent sandwich. It is the type of sandwich where the first time that I had it, we're talking this was years ago. The first time that I had it, I went back the next day.
That's a compelling case.
At the same time, I feel like the quality might have waned over time, to be honest.
Interesting.
It's either I've been too exposed to it or the quality has waned. But now you're kind of like the turkey tastes good, but sometimes you're just like, this is a little, it's just like a lot in there, right? Like I want kind of an even mix of the things. There's almost never.
Well, apparently it needs to be evenly distributed. It can't be asymmetric and still be a sandwich.
There's never enough sauce also. Like, I want all the sauce. I want all the ranch.
You went up and got a cup of ranch to go along.
Yes. I want it to be, like, dripping with ranch. In the same way that the Raging Cajun, I want it to be raging, right?
It always is.
No, I've had times.
All right.
I've had times.
All right, that's fair.
I think that location is better than the Queen Anne one.
I've not been to the Queen Anne one, like I said.
So, okay.
It feels a little like a replica copy of a copy, like in Multiplicity.
Are we going to rate these on a scale of 100?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to give Honey Hole. I'm going to be a little bit nice to Honey Hole, knowing that I really like their sandwiches generally. I'm going to give it a 91.
I scored an 84.
Wow.
I was underwhelmed again. I mean, look,
you picked
obviously
off like 60% of the sandwich.
Uh-huh. Obviously, I forgot to not order the tomatoes. I always forget that, but I did successfully manage it subsequently at the other coast, which is one of the advantages of going back to back, is that I could remember and not make that mistake. I mean, obviously, a lot of people love Honey Hole, yourself included. I've had two sandwiches there. I'm just not seeing it.
I do think that Honey Hole might have gotten a little bit worse over the last few years.
Yeah, you said that.
So. Okay, so then the other coast.
So the Raging Cajun is I mentioned earlier, Cajun-style turkey, a little spicy. Then you've got melted cheese, onions, potentially tomatoes if you don't ask for them not on there as I did, and then kind of a spicy chipotle mayo type sauce.
A generous helping.
Oh, I mean, the number one thing about the other coast is, first, I would say, do not go there like in a date situation or anything like that, because A, you're going to be just a mess after eating it, no matter how many napkins you use, and you're going to want a generous number of napkins going in. Also, a lot of water because of the fact that it is spicy. And then number two, the onions, your breath is going to be rough for a while there. I went home and brushed my teeth.
So they're not all that dissimilar sandwiches,
no,
right?
They're very similar. And that was actually one thing that was interesting about the comparison, because I didn't realize that about, like, again, your favorite sandwich there.
And, you know, honestly, if you could combine these sandwiches, if you could take the turkey from Honey Hole, maybe a little bit less, put it on that Ragin' Cajun, you would have maybe the perfect sandwich.
I wouldn't. They already have the perfect sandwich in the Ragin' Cajun. I wouldn't change a thing.
Wow, you're coming in a little bit too hot for the first sandwich we're talking about.
Well, I mean, this is like when we started with Tacos Chukis
last week.
Okay, that's fine.
But the one that you had today while you were eating it, I had just eaten a sandwich, and I was like, fuck, that looks good.
Because it was really good.
And it smells good. So you want the sauce to be dripping off of there.
Yes.
Like, you want so... Because it's excellent.
It's right? Great sauce.
And it's the thing is about... this chipotle mayo sauce or whatever it is, you can never recreate good restaurant sauce at home. No matter what you're doing, I'm talking about any restaurant, any sauce.
I don't know if I tried that much, but yes.
I got a bottle of, because I think the Taco Bell Spicy Ranch sauce is an excellent sauce, right? And I got a bottle of packaged Taco Bell Spicy Ranch. Even then, as packaged by the company, it still doesn't taste as good.
By the way, officially, it's spicy salsa mayo.
Spicy salsa mayo.
And pepper jack cheese.
Hearing a song randomly on the radio versus turning it on yourself. Oh, it'll never sound as good.
That's a great analogy. I love that.
And it'll never taste as good when you're trying to recreate the sauce. And that's why you need a lot of that sauce. I should either get the detonator or order extra.
Yeah. Sometimes, this reminds me of going to Pecos Pit Barbecue, which will not be eligible for the sandwich competition because of the fact that those sandwiches will be eligible for the barbecue competition.
We've
summer
had some
2020.
Things that have been eligible for a lot of stuff.
Places that have been, but the same sandwich can't compete in multiple.
Okay, yeah, things. We have rules here. Every man must have a code.
This is a society. What are we doing? Anyways, but I'll order it there extra messy, so they'll give me more barbecue sauce. Uh-huh. And maybe that's the play here, is to order it extra with extra sauce.
Okay. That said, I did have what I would describe as maybe, like, it's still a Ragin' Cajun. But it was a below average Ragin' Cajun.
It was light on sauce?
It was just kind of the whole thing just really didn't stand out that much.
Also, so crispy.
I was there with guests, and I like really wanted them to love it. And I think people liked it, but it wasn't like they didn't eat the sandwich. It didn't change their lives. You know what I mean? Like I was the host. I'm the person who's supposed to like know and care about food, and I'm taking them to a restaurant, and they're lukewarm on it.
I would say the one place that's like 100% guaranteed no one has ever gone there and not thought it was amazing is Tacos Chukis. Like, that's the one place we've found, I think, that has that 100% approval rating.
That could be. Tacos Chukis.
Because even Loretta's, people will go there and be underwhelmed, I think.
Yeah.
Some people will not even say it's Seattle's best burger. I don't have crazy takes like that. I don't know what they're doing.
But I'm going to give the other coast a 94.
I gave it a 98.
98?
Yeah.
Wow. Have you ever had another item there?
Not since I first ordered the Ragin' Cajun, no.
We like to call that Kevin's mistake.
Look, I have regrets. I mean, I think the other coast is actually a good example of something I believe strongly, which is that in general, I've mentioned this on the pod before, a restaurant is only as good or as bad as the best item on the menu.
I mean, that's how Oink won the Pelton Cast search for Seattle's best ramen, right?
You don't need to order two or three different ramens when you go there. You just need to order the one that's really good.
I like that idea about ordering two to three ramens. No, I totally agree with that.
Yep. Do we have any thoughts on where we should go next week in our search for Seattle's best sandwich.
I'm down for whatever. Maybe we should get some deli sandwiches next week.
Like traditional deli sandwiches?
Yeah, I want to do Hitchcock.
Okay, that's an easy one for me to get to.
It's been a while since I've done it.
It's been a while for me too, actually. So Hitchcock Deli is located in Georgetown. Not far, as Tristan mentioned, from Bar Ciudad. It originally was, the original location is on Bainbridge Island, and that's the Seattle location. So a longtime favorite of ours.
We should also, if we can, try to hit up Frawley too.
Okay, we'll see what the schedule is next week.
Okay,
all right. Well, let's get back to sports, and it's time for your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
So, I, much like Ichiro, left it all on the field last week.
Those are some amazing takes, but it's time for to come in for some with some for opening day this Thursday. Can I tell you a story about a major league team that everyone wrote off before the season? They were one of baseball's sad sack franchises. They hadn't won anything in forever. They sold off their high-priced stars during the offseason and replaced them with unknowns. Even the groundskeepers were saying, they're shitty. But this group of has-beens and cast-offs came together to prove the doubters wrong and make the playoffs. Major League? No, I'm talking about the plot of the 2019 Seattle Mariners. They're undefeated! And while, yes, that's technically true of 30 other MLB teams until Thursday's American opening day, the M's actually have two wins to their credit, too. They're all alone in first place, a game up on the Astros, a game up on the Angels, and everybody else in baseball. Everything went perfectly for the Mariners across the sea in Japan. Even Ichiro retired without putting up a fight. So why can't the Mariners prove their nefarious owner, Rachel Phelps, wrong? Why can't veteran catcher Omar Narvaez find love with his ex-wife? And why can't they win the AL West?
Omar Narvaez?
Yeah, he's the Mariners catcher.
Is that a real baseball player in the Mariners?
Oh, introducing the MLB player.
Trying to remember him from Major League.
I got to tell you, I originally thought it was Dioner Navarro, but that person is not in baseball anymore.
All right.
That's what I had in my head.
Okay. I thought it was a Major League character like Rick the Wild Thing Vaughn.
No.
Pedro Serrano.
I mean, obviously that was a reference to Jake, the catcher.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Do you have any other thoughts, additional thoughts on Ichiro as of his retirement?
I thought we already talked about Ichiro retiring. Hasn't this happened two or three times?
Well, he didn't technically retire last year when he was released by the Mariners and put into a player coach role that was weird and awkward. Like, I don't know if they had this plan all along for him to retire after the series in Japan. Obviously, it was a fitting send-off for him to get to play in his home country one more time. I mean, are there any memories of Ichiro's career that stand out? Nothing.
My feelings, I don't need to rehash my feelings about Ichiro.
All right.
Okay, we're starting the season off on a good note.
I want to at least mention, like, the throw from right field against the A's in his rookie season, like, the first week or two of his rookie season. And he was like, whoa, who is this guy? Like, we knew who Ichiro was.
Did he win
like
the MVP that year?
He did.
Okay.
Yeah. Analytics has come around. Sabermetrics has come around on Ichiro. There's been a reevaluation.
Has there really?
I think so.
A reevaluation of the reevaluation.
Yes.
There we go. That's what baseball's about.
A counter take. Well, first off, war is constantly changing. I don't know if you're aware of this.
What is it good for? I hated the Mariners during this time period that you're talking about. I don't have fond memories of this throw.
All right. Well, the Mariners, having...
Call me when Ken Griffey Jr. retires again.
Worked their way across the Pacific Ocean and back to Seattle to play some exhibition games here at newly renamed T-Mobile Park.
Oh, my God. That's what we have some takes about. It is bad.
It's pretty garish. The combination of pink with the green of the stadium.
The font of it, it's like...
It doesn't fit.
It looks so bad. What also, the lights are already out. What is going... How
are
did
they?
That possibly happen?
I don't... I'm unaware of this.
Just driving by, it's like part of the T-Mobile is... Either, like, the lights didn't work when they were installed.
This is a metaphor for something.
It is bad news, that T-Mobile Park. I think T-Mobile should seriously reconsider this entire sponsorship.
But good news, Lil Woody's is there now.
There we go.
Yeah.
You need to, next time you're driving by, next time you're about to get in that tunnel. Have you been in the tunnel, by the way?
I went in the tunnel last Friday when I was going to see Illuminati Hotties. Wow. Sold out show.
There we go.
Let me tell you, that tunnel, it goes a long ways underground. You're in there a long time. That's my take. That's my tunnel take.
The tunnel's great. I'm actually quite pro-tunnel, but I'm very anti-T-Mobile Park.
Okay.
It just looks terrible on there. Like, Safeco Field fit, and it was clear that they, like, spent time and, like, made it fit with the design of the stadium. That T-Mobile Park, they just threw it up randomly.
And they're slapping it on there, yeah.
Oh, man.
The Mariners will open their U.S. schedule on Thursday against the Boston Red Sox as the start of a four-game series before welcoming the L.A. Angels for a two-game series against their $420 million man, Mike Trout.
They should have to approve the street vacation just to try to block the eyesore that is the sign that says T-Mobile Park.
This is a take here. The Seattle Sounders spent last weekend on international break, where Jordan Morris got the start for the U.S. men's national team, has returned to the SMNT in a 1-0 friendly win over Ecuador. And then on Tuesday night, the roles of the Sounders on the USMNT reversed as Christian Roldan started in a 1-1 draw against Chile, with Morris coming on as a reserve.
They let the players coach and the coaches play.
No. This season, the Sounders will get back to the long MLS regular season by traveling north of the border to face the Cascadia rival Vancouver Whitecaps.
That's the undefeated Seattle Sounders to you.
Okay, fair. To the perfect Seattle Sounders. They will be facing Vancouver, who is the inverse of that, going 0-3-0 in their first three matches of the season. They are one of two remaining MLS teams with 0 points, the San Jose Earthquakes being the other. They have been maybe a little unlucky. They've lost all three matches by one goal, but have allowed 7 goals in those three games. Vancouver narrowly missed out on the MLS Cup playoffs last year, but this was a little predictable. They had a minus 13 goal differential and a bottom six ranking in ESPN's Soccer Power Index. They're now in the bottom three there. The Whitecaps do have Freddie Montero, Sounders legend, back with them after playing the 2017 season in Vancouver on loan. He's now permanently there, has started all three games with 1 goal there. The Sounders, off to another, after being really lucky in terms of expected goals last season, off to another pretty lucky start there per American Soccer Analysis. They have an expected goal differential of plus 1.4 and an actual goal differential of plus 5. So we'll see if they can keep that going this weekend or if that regresses.
Bring on the coup, though. Let's keep this undefeated season going.
For sure, the start of another Cascadia Cup, trying to earn that trophy. The Seattle Seahawks making some news with the NFL owners meetings this week. Doug Baldwin told KJR last week that he has, quote, more surgeries on the way most likely, and head coach Pete Carroll confirmed at the owners meetings that Baldwin will have surgery to repair a sports hernia in April. So a rough offseason for Doug Baldwin coming off his injury-plagued 2018 campaign.
This is bad.
It's not great. It's not the best. Seahawks should probably, we haven't heard any more on the Jordy Nelson front, but they should probably be looking to sign to draft a receiver.
I kind of forgot about Jordy Nelson. Okay, so what do you think this means for the Seahawks as far as their approach over this offseason?
I mean, I'm not sure it means that much, but you can't necessarily count on Baldwin being 100%, I think, at this point at the start of training camp, especially if there's additional surgeries after this one, which it seems like are possible, but we don't know any details on what those might entail.
Their first pick almost has to be a wide receiver. They have to draft a wide receiver within one of their first three picks in the draft.
Yeah, they have to address it at a point where you can expect someone to realistically come in and play right away. And, of course, with Baldwin's age, you know.
Yeah, even long term. I mean, there are no real young receivers that the Seahawks are counting on at this point.
Not David Moore?
No.
No.
That to me is the biggest difference, where it's like in the draft, I would be pretty surprised if their first pick wasn't either A, a safety, or B, a receiver.
Do we think there's any chance Jermaine Kearse comes back?
Probably not.
I kind of feel like if that was going to happen, it probably would have happened already, but maybe they're waiting out his market and trying to get him on the cheap. I don't know.
Was he released, though? Like, would they have to pay a comp pick to sign Jermaine Kearse?
He would qualify as a comp pick. Now, the current situation in terms of comp picks, we'll get to this in a second when we talk about the players they're meeting with. The Seahawks are now a net plus five in terms of qualifying free agents because Maurice Alexander, special teams safety, signed with the Bills last week.
There's a max amount of comp picks that can be awarded to any teams.
Yeah, which is four. So at this point, they can sign one player to a cheap contract.
Isn't there a limit on the total amount of comp picks that are awarded for all teams?
Yeah, 32.
So the Seahawks aren't necessarily guaranteed of getting four comp picks.
At this point, they would.
Okay.
I think they are likely to get them. It also, this also is counting at this point, still Mike Iupati among the, against that calculation. If it is concluded that he doesn't count as a qualifying free agent, then the Seahawks would be in an even better position because anyone they sign as a free agent is probably going to be cheaper than Iupati, and then they would have the potential to sign two while still not, you know, taking away one of their four picks.
Okay.
So some other players they are looking at that they plan to meet with or have in for visits. Jason LaConfora of CBSSports.com reports that they plan to meet with former Packer outside linebacker Nick Perry, who was waived by Green Bay after seven seasons. He missed the final seven games of 2018 with a knee injury that put him on IR. Had just 1.5 sacks and 302 snaps before that. But if you look at the previous two seasons, 18 sacks in 1,045 snaps, and notably was recruited to USC by one Peter Clay Carroll, who subsequently left for the Seahawks after Perry's redshirt freshman season.
Okay.
I mean, he's the kind of player I think that it's good to be looking at. A buy-low candidate coming off an injury doesn't count. There's a lot to like at this, assuming the price is right.
I mean, this would be low, low money.
You would think. The other player scheduled to come in for a visit, according to Matt Barrows of The Athletic, who covers the 49ers, is defensive tackle Earl Mitchell, who played in San Francisco last season. He would be a qualifying free agent. Definitely a run-stuffing defensive tackle. Played nose tackle in 3-4 in the past.
They love a run-stuffing tackle.
They love a run-stuffing defensive tackle. He'd be in kind of the Shamar Stephen role from last year, I think.
Which would be fine. And they could probably afford to sign him at a low-money contract.
Yes.
Nick Perry could be interesting. I mean, look, he may just be a camp guy. If they were to sign him, could be released before the season. I wouldn't be shocked. But at the same time, he's somebody who they could just have around as a depth linebacker, too. Really no negative
well,
there.
He'd be a defensive end for the Seahawks.
Okay. Even better.
You know, that's definitely the need, is that rush-in position. Carroll did mention Jacob Martin, who had a solid rookie season, you know, unexpectedly, I think. You know, Rasheem Green maybe more in his second season. You'd count on him playing a larger role. But I think you do want to probably bring in a veteran at that spot. As for linebacker, Carroll talked about he thinks this could be the best group they've ever had. Now, that assumes that they have Michael Kendricks, whose sentencing on insider trading is no longer scheduled. That hearing was scheduled for April 4th, but now has been postponed indefinitely, as first reported by John P. Gilbert on Field Goals. And still unclear how much jail time, if any, he'll have to serve. I don't think we've talked about the fact that the contract that Seahawks signed him to includes no guaranteed money at signing. So in the event that, you know, he is unable to play, they won't pay him anything, but they are certainly acting as if they plan to have him this
season. Can I get the Ron Howard voice? It's not. Like, this, it's not the best linebacking core they've ever had.
I mean, what would you say is the best linebacking core they've ever had?
The same core 3 years ago.
I mean, Wagner is better now. And 3 years ago, who is it?
Is he better, or does he just have more accolades?
Who is it weak side linebacker then, or strong side linebacker, I guess?
I don't know, Bruce Irvin?
I mean, Bruce Irvin wasn't, like, a great linebacker. I think his value was more sliding down to defensive end in passing situations.
Still had value there, but also you had KJ Wright 3 years younger and 3 years healthier.
That is a fair point.
Bobby Wagner last season was probably better than he was maybe 3 years ago. But the difference can't be that great. I think it might be more just that he receives a little bit more of the accolades because there aren't the other superstars on defense.
That could be possible. I still think he's continued to improve well into his career. The other move the Seahawks made is re-signing cornerback Nico Thorpe, who could be in the mix at the slot corner position to replace Justin Coleman, and also will continue to play an important role on special teams. So good to have him back. Now, the only two remaining unrestricted free agents for the Seahawks, Deion Jordan and Sebastian Janikowski.
Not holding my breath on Seabass.
You know, you really want to have like as many kickers in camp as possible. I've always found
they just want to run back the camp that they had last year. Jason Myers and Sebastian Janikowski. Oh,
but you got Sam Ficken in the mix too. Maybe draft a kicker. Just yeah. Really amp up the competition there, because if there's any position where you can learn anything about over a small sample,
you're
size,
really trying to get them to draft a kicker because of your bold prediction. It's not happening.
You can't rule that out.
They're not spending the money that they spent on Jason Myers and drafting a damn kicker.
Rule that out. I'm joking.
Husky softball swept reeling Oregon by a combined 28-5 margin, including run rule wins on both Sunday and Monday after needing 10 innings in the first game on Saturday. And Eugene hit 5 home runs on Sunday. The bats really came alive against the struggling Oregon team. The Huskies back home to host a midweek game on Wednesday against Cal Poly before the Oregon State Beavers come to town this weekend, sporting a 1-5 record in conference play. We wrap things up with UW men's basketball, whose season came to an end in the NCAA tournament last weekend after a 78-61 win on Friday against Utah State, the Huskies' first NCAA tournament win in 8 years and their first game in that span. The run ended much as it did in 2011, although not nearly as close, with an 81-59 loss to top-seeded North Carolina. And I have one question to ask in the wake of that game. Why do we even watch college basketball? It was good on Friday.
It was just hard to even get worked up during this game.
I mean, the Huskies were, quite frankly, outclassed. Like, everything needed to go right for them to pull this upset, and it just didn't. North Carolina shot 9 of 21 on threes. Like, they were going to need to miss a bunch of those. The Huskies were going to have to shoot well on threes. They didn't. Predictably, that regressed to the mean. So, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, I don't think it was weird to see, like, takes about, like, oh, no Sweet 16 this year. Like, an early exit. Seattle Times called it an, quote, early exit from the NCAA tournament. Like, guys, there's only 16 teams in the country out of 350 that make it. Like, even if you had really high expectations for the Huskies coming into the season, a Sweet 16 shouldn't have been, like, considered the expectation.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, they were ranked in the top 25.
But they were 25.
They were 25, and they finished as one of the last 32 teams.
Yeah, I mean, they were who we thought they were.
I mean,
actually, who we thought they were. That was not what he came in the NCAA tournament.
Did this team exceed expectations, meet expectations, or not meet expectations?
I would say meet expectations. They took care of business against a weak Pac-12 and won a game in the NCAA tournament. Like, it's a tremendous accomplishment for this great senior class to have gotten them, you know, in the program in 2 years from the 2-16 disaster that was 2016-17 to back to the NCAA tournament. I mean, if you would have told me in the wake of Lorenzo Romar's firing that the Huskies were going to win a game in the NCAA tournament in 2 years, I would have been ecstatic about that.
It's funny how quickly you can go from, like, if you would have told us before the season, like, this team will make the NCAA tournament, they will play North Carolina and lose. They will win a game in the NCAA tournament, play North Carolina and lose. We'd be like, sign me up.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that seems like a great year. But then when you're in the moment, all of a sudden it's Seattle Times being like, early exit for the Dogs. And it's just like, we don't have to look at things negatively.
Yeah.
There really aren't large negatives to take away from this.
I mean, I think the one negative to take from this season is, so here's a wild stat that I dug up. The UW offense this year ended up ranking worse in KenPom's adjusted offensive efficiency than any of Lorenzo Romar's last 14 seasons, including the aforementioned 2-16 team, finished one spot higher in adjusted offensive efficiency. So they survived that this year because of the fact that their defense was so incredible. It was better than all but 1 year of the Romar era. Weirdly, 2008-09, I would not have guessed that as the best defense of the Romar era.
I don't really remember this team.
That was the team that lost to Purdue in the second round in Portland as a 4-seed.
Team.
It was a good team, but you don't really think of it as defense. It was like Brockman, MBA, Isaiah, Justin Dentman. They were super small on the perimeter. Not a lot of rim protection, but they were good defensively, apparently. But the offense clearly has to get better if they're going to be like a legitimate NCAA tournament contender.
No shit.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other positive that I take away from this is similarly to, I would say, Husky football, where we have a lot of confidence in the coaching staff that they're able to take, I don't want to say basically anybody, but that coaching staff has been able to put together a good defense while losing players to the NFL and very high draft picks.
Yes.
Matisse Thybulle is a unique defensive player. He's probably not replaceable defensive player.
He's not. He covered a lot of gaps.
Is he an 80% replaceable defensive player? If you put Naz Carter in that exact same position that Matisse was playing.
I mean, Jamal Bey is the closer comparison to Thybulle.
But or Jamal Bey, whatever. If you're putting somebody into that position, will they be able to come close to what Matisse did? I think that they will be able to. Like, this Husky
team... No, I don't think that. I mean, look, Matisse Thybulle is the best. Like, many people have called him the best perimeter zone defender they've ever seen, including Hop. He submitted one of the greatest defensive seasons by a perimeter player in college basketball history. Like, look, let's not... Like,
I'm just saying this is going to be a good defensive team next year.
But here's why it's encouraging. What's encouraging to me is... Well, Thybulle was a big part of this. The Huskies have been really good defensively, despite the fact that they do not really have the kind of personnel that you'd want in a Syracuse-style zone. Like, you look at Syracuse, it is all really long, athletic players. Like, they recruit a specific type.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody in the Husky front line who fits that. Like, Sam Timmons is bulky and... You know, not a particularly athletic defender. Noah Dickerson's undersized, even though he's phenomenal offensively. And look, those guys have done great given those tools. But, you know, there's guys coming in and potentially down the road who are going to be probably a better fit in the front court for what Hop is trying to do.
Yeah, I feel good about it.
So let's start with by looking into 2019-20 by talking about the recruiting class, currently ranked number 13 by ESPN Recruiting Nation. That's led by the number 4 overall recruit according to ESPN and center Isaiah Stewart.
God, I forgot about Isaiah Stewart.
Who is massive. He was at a game. He was at the, I think the Oregon State game at the end of conference play. And like that was the number one takeaway. Like that's a big dude, a legit 7-footer. Is he
skinny?
He's not.
Or does he have some bulk on him?
He's got some bulk. I mean, he's not huge, but he's not a rail or anything like that.
Okay.
Like the Huskies' other target. So he's currently playing in the McDonald's High School All-America game, or practicing leading up to the game, which will be played Wednesday at 4 p.m. on ESPN2, alongside, of course, the number 6 overall recruiting according to ESPN and the number 1 projected player in our 2020 NBA mock draft, Jaden McDaniels from Federal Way High School, who is the Huskies' primary target. His final 5 are UW, Kentucky, San Diego State, where his other older brother Jalen plays for now, although he will quite possibly declare for the NBA draft, Texas, and then UCLA.
Please go to the NBA, Jalen.
Yeah, so there's no incentive to play.
You'll be a first-round pick, easy. ESPN's Kevin Pelton said it here first.
I did not say that. For the record, Jonathan Gavoni and Mike Schmitz might say. I think the Huskies are the favorite to get Jaden McDaniels.
Let's get it!
It's unclear when he's going to announce. He didn't want to talk about it at the McDonald's practices. Usually when players wait to this point, it's after they finish with kind of the whole slate of all-star games. Jaden will not be participating in the Nike Hoop Summit in Portland in a couple weeks here, although Isaiah Stewart will be there for that game. So it'll be a good first look at Stewart for me in the practices and in that game. But he would really kind of transform this and take it into a top 5 class.
Wow.
So the Huskies also have a pair of 4-star wings, according to ESPN's rankings, in Raekwon Battle from Marysville Pulchuk, and then Marcus Sahonis from Portland. And then they have one open scholarship at the moment, although that could increase to 2 depending what happens with Jalen Noel. So Mike Hopkins told KJR on Tuesday that he expects Noel to test the waters in the NBA draft.
Definitely is going to declare.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason not to declare. You can go back twice without penalties. So, you know, if you're a sophomore, there's no issue with it. So we've talked about this a little on the pod. There's not the kind of NBA interest in Noel that there is in Matisse Thybulle. But In the last few weeks, I did start to hear a little bit more. You know, he could be a second round pick. I think that, you know, he is someone who's on team's radar. I think the most likely scenario for him, if he were to declare, is probably to end up on a two-way contract. So either, you know, in the back half of the second round, teams will draft players who agree to play for them on a two-way contract, or you go undrafted and end up on a two-way contract.
Without basically putting words into his mouth or whatever, if you were advising Jalen Noel, would you tell him to declare right now? Well, I guess to declare, yes. But would you tell him to go out right now, were that to be the most likely scenario?
Taking away the Husky aspect of it, speaking strictly for an NBA perspective.
Yeah, you're Jalen Noel's uncle right now.
I think that he, you know, needs a chance to sell scouts. I mean, maybe he will be able to do that in workouts over the next couple months here. But again, you know, he's not really been on everyone's radar. And I think a lot of people haven't been evaluating him with an eye towards 2020 or 2019. They've been evaluating him with an eye towards 2020 and not having him at the front of mind. Like when people come out to UW games, obviously you're seeing Noel, but you're coming to watch Matisse Thybulle because you know he's going to be in the draft. And now it looks quite possibly like he's going to be in the first round. He's bumped up to, I think, number 27 in the latest top 100 from Givony.
Can't even dribble.
It was not a great weekend for Thybulle offensively. Made some shots.
It's like I love Matisse, but also like, man, whew, really like some offense out there.
Yes.
And he just does not provide that. I think Matisse eventually will be an NBA caliber, like corner three shooter.
Because the form is there. He shoots well from the free throw line. Like all the predictor indicators that someone like me looks for are there. But the shots just don't go in as frequently as they should.
Yeah, they seem like they're going to, but they just don't. When he's drafted by the Spurs, though.
I mean, it is a very much in play, although, you know, he's probably more of a guard than they're going to be looking for with Derek White and DeJounte Murray.
He's being drafted by the Spurs, the Nuggets.
Oh, man, the Nuggets would be really interesting. They don't have their first-round pick.
Or though. The Bucks, too. God, imagine him on the Bucks.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Philly is a team that Mike Schmidt said on the Hoop Collective that we did together a couple weeks ago has been looking at Thybulle.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
There we go. Too bad he can't reunite with Markel. Okay, so let's put a percentage chance of victory on Jalen being here next year. I don't know why I say victory. Percentage chance of returning?
I would say 55%.
Really?
Yeah.
I think he's gone.
I mean, to me, it's all about whether he declares with an agent or not.
Well, if he declares with an agent, he's gone.
But yeah, but like...
Like, yes, of course.
Look, when he gets objective feedback from the NBA, I don't think it's going to be what he wants to hear or is expecting to hear.
Okay.
I'll put it that way.
So, okay, what does the roster look like for next year, both with and without Jaden McDaniels?
So it'll be a younger roster next year. Sam Timmons is the only senior set to be on the roster. You got four juniors. I think the junior class, assuming Noel does come back, will really be the strength. I mean, either way, it's probably going to be the strength of the team, but you've got Naz Carter probably stepping into a larger role, Hamir Wright, who's been starting, and then that also includes transfer Quade Green from Kentucky, who, when he becomes eligible, there's some rumors that he might be eligible at the start of the year with the changes to the transfer rules. He will be the starting point guard whenever he's able to play, and one of the concerns probably is, especially if Noel does leave, point guard depth in that first couple months of the season before he would become eligible potentially at the quarter break.
Well, and ball handling without him. I mean, like... really, when you look at it, Jalen's the only ball handler in the entire team.
I mean, Elijah Hardy's going to have to play a bigger role next year, but he did not see a lot of action.
I'm pretty sure he's a cornerback. Like Elijah Hardy, we're counting on him having a huge season in the football team.
I mean, if he were a quarterback, you'd go to the NFL. It's that simple. So at point guard, you've got Quade Green when he becomes eligible and Hardy. At shooting guard, Noel if he comes back, Sahonis, and then... You know, if Noel comes back, I think Naz Carter probably starts at small forward with Jamal Bey coming off the bench. Otherwise, then those are your two starting wings, Carter and Bey, with Battle then backing up. At power forward, you've got Wright and Nate Roberts, who redshirted this year but will be in the mix next year. And then at center, Stewart presumably almost certainly comes in as the starter with Timmons, and then Brian Penn-Johnson, who played sparingly as a freshman, dealt with some injuries.
Okay, so where does Jaden McDaniels slot in there if he chooses UW?
He starts at power forward.
Okay, and Hamir is coming off the bench?
Yes.
Do you think that his choice affects Jalen Noel?
I don't think so, but you never know. I mean, in some ways it probably could be a negative in terms of, you know, there's going to be more competition for shots on offense. Noel may not be the clear go-to guy, although he will have the ball in his hand. So, you know, a lot of the time more than McDaniels and Isaiah Stewart would. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, on the one hand, if McDaniels does come, it's kind of a return to, you know, what we saw in the late days of the Romar era, where you're really heavily dependent on probable one-and-done players, and that's not always a great formula for success. But you do have, I think, more experience to go around them, you know, particularly a point guard with Quade Green, and especially if Noel comes back.
I mean, it really feels like his decision is going to affect whether this team is like a potentially winning the Pac-12 type of team or having a season where they're going to need to develop some players type of team.
I mean, I don't think it's going to be a rebuilding season. I guess if Noel leaves...
Who starts at shooting guard? I mean, Jamal Bey and Nas Carter are going to start.
Bey, yeah.
Still, just like the depth after that is so brutal.
Yes.
I
think at that point you'd probably be getting aggressive to try to find a JC transfer or someone who would be immediately eligible.
Okay.
Unfortunately, grad transfers aren't really an option for the Huskies. That's what you would be looking for if they were.
If only they were Oregon.
Or Gonzaga.
Why? Is it because it's so easy to get into Gonzaga?
Well, it's a private school, so the rules are a little different.
Oh, God. We need Lori Loughlin out here.
we do not need Lori Loughlin.
but so this team, the hypothetical team for next year, let's say that Jalen comes back. They're a younger team, probably more talented than the team that we have currently seen.
I mean, there's definitely more NBA potential, yeah.
But also with a little bit less depth, but still some depth and kind of experience in that depth also.
I mean, the best version, again, the Noel and McDaniels version of the Huskies could be a pretty darn good team. I mean, I think that would be a team that would be ranked higher coming into the season than this year's team.
Man.
I mean, that would be a top five recruiting class easy at that point.
To me, the real linchpin is not Jaden McDaniels, is not Isaiah Stewart, is not even necessarily Jalen Noel. It's what is Quade Green.
Right.
Like, if Quade Green is everything that David Crisp wasn't, if he's an excellent ball handler, distributor, free throw shooter, shooter, like, we have the whole ceiling for what the team can do is completely different.
And, yeah, I mean, that's where I think we'll learn a lot more about what Mike Hopkins' offense can look like next year, because he hasn't had that pick-and-roll playmaker with Crisp at point guard, you know, as well as Crisp played in conference play this year. That's just not and won't ever be his game. Green is a different kind of distributor. I mean, he came in as a really highly touted prospect to Kentucky. As I mentioned, had the highest assist rate that is on record in the several years of UIBL data that I've translated using some stats compiled by Neil Johnson of ESPN Stats and Info. And then also someone who can stretch the floor, shot 38% on threes as a freshman, 42% in the 9 games he played as a sophomore before deciding to transfer.
Why did he transfer?
I mean, he'd been bumped out of the starting lineup by Ashton Higgins.
Was he playing well, though?
He was playing reasonably well. He wasn't playing poorly. I mean, this is just Kentucky. Like, if you stay around a second year, you get recruited over because they've got other guys coming. So they've got Ashton Higgins, who's probably a first-round pick in the NBA.
Man. I mean, I'm fired up about Quade Green. I hope that he's eligible right away. But, having a true point guard in the sense is something the Huskies haven't had since Isaiah Thomas.
I mean, Andrew Andrews.
Andrew Andrews.
There was nothing wrong. Andrew Andrews was one of the best offensive players in college basketball as a senior.
I feel like just because he didn't make the NCAA tournament.
No.
Ever.
I think he redshirted the year. He wouldn't have even been. Yeah, no, he never did.
So his whole tenure has kind of been forgotten to the sands of time.
Absolutely.
Which I feel kind of bad for Andrew Andrews because he was good.
He had an incredible career.
But having a point guard, like, we've just been without it for so long.
Yeah.
It's like, please, Lord, give us a point guard. And hopefully Kwadi Green can be that, you know, because the distribution plus being able to shoot is like, it's what this team has needed for 4 years.
Yep. Whew. I mean, look, the offense was pretty good with Markelle Fultz at the controls. That worked out too.
Didn't you say they were one spot better than that 2-16 team is the Markelle Fultz team, right?
Yeah, but that happened because he got injured.
Because he wasn't playing.
Okay.
All right, well,
don't say because he wasn't playing. He was injured. He had knee surgery after the season. We've learned that now. Like, the whole, like, oh, he's shedding it down for the NBA draft. No, that was made up.
I just meant literally he wasn't playing.
All right, I just want that out there on the record.
So sensitive about this.
Gee, I don't understand why anyone would be sensitive about Markelle Fultz injury stuff. That's not been an issue at all.
But what I'm saying is we went into the season, starting this year, saying this is the year that the Huskies need to make the NCAA tournament, or it may be a long time after, which, A, they did it. Great.
Yes.
Congrats.
We didn't go into the year, by the way, saying that. We said that in, like, December, when it was like, wow, they're not even good, even though they have four seniors. that's when we said that. It was a dark time. It was right before the Kwadi Green transfer news.
But they achieved those goals, and then since then, you look at this roster, you have a top five prospect in Isaiah Stewart coming back. You have a player who is initially committed and played at Kentucky, so obviously it was a very high prospect when he's coming in. You have Naz Carter, who really showed some things, I think, during the NCAA tournament and looks like he could very well be an explosive player. Hamir Wright definitely did some stuff. Like, there's talent on this team. The cupboard is not empty.
No, very much not the case. So Mike Hopkins signed a new 6-year contract through 2025 last week, paying him a total of $17.5 million over that span. He had been, according to USA Today's database, 7th of the 10 public school coaches in the Pac-12 in play during the 2018-19 season. Private schools Stanford and USC don't have to release contract details for their coaches. He doesn't actually necessarily move up that much higher with this new deal. He will surpass Wayne Tinkle and maybe Bobby Hurley, depending on how much of a raise Hurley gets from year to year. Hopkins has a $6 million buyout if you lose prior to March 2021, a $3 million buyout through March 2023, and then a $1 million buyout through March 2024 before the final year of this contract. So, you know, once the ink is dry, he will almost certainly be here at least the next 2 years. So,
okay.
Good to get that done.
Does that give the Huskies a little bit of buffer and confidence should something happen with Jim Boeheim?
I think that's part of the idea, yeah.
I mean, like, that's the concern out there, right? Is that if that Syracuse job opens, he's had it in the back of his mind that, like, yes, I know I was the heir apparent at Syracuse, but I want to go get head coaching experience. And if that Syracuse job opens, they're probably going to call.
I think they're definitely going to call. It'd be weird if they didn't call.
One of the first calls that Syracuse will make would still be to Mike Hopkins.
It's also not like there's a lot of other Jim Boeheim assistants out there leading successful programs of their own. There's not much of a coaching tree. So, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that offers any guarantees necessarily, but that's why they're stepping up here, along with, you know, the success they've enjoyed.
6-year contract.
I mean, that's
college deals are ridiculous.
Yes. I mean, the real ridiculous one is, like, if you're Sean Miller and you get paid, even if you get fired for cause, that's a pretty good setup.
Your we should all be Sean Miller's there. Agent. Sean Miller's agent should be our agent for life.
Yes, I agree with that.
He should be negotiating the price of your Raging Cajuns.
He would do a better job than I would, that's for
you
sure.
You'd get free Raging Cajuns for a year.
I've lost all my leverage. In further coaching news, John Rothstein of SI.com reported Tuesday night that Washington State will hire Kyle Smith from the University of San Francisco as Ernie Kent's replacement. And I like this hire.
Okay.
So if you're Wazoo...
from what standpoint do you like this hire?
If you're Wazoo, you need to recruit someone or hire someone who is going to be able to win without much talent. Because, okay, like, look, ultimately, you're never going to be able to compete recruiting-wise in Pullman, Washington with Seattle and L.A. and Tempe, Arizona, and Salt Lake City. Like, that's just not happening. Boulder.
I suppose that's true.
It's true.
It's probably true of everything. Even in times that Wazoo's been, like, a pretty good football school, they have not been doing it with highly recruited players.
Yeah, they do it with an unorthodox scheme with Mike Leach. So I like the idea of them going out and hiring Michigan's defensive assistant, Luke Yalick.
I was going to say, like, you had all these ideas for coaches.
I did. But I hadn't thought about Kyle Smith, but here, what I like about him, so USF this year, despite kind of a disappointing end to their season, was the number 66 team, or number 67. They dropped one spot based on the NIT results tonight in Ken Pom rankings. Do you know where that would have put them in the Pac-12?
Wow, like fourth?
I've got to look this up here, but the answer is disturbingly high in the Pacific 12 Conference. They would have been 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth, just behind Colorado at number 67. And obviously he's doing that not with top-tier talent at USF. Instead, doing it with an analytically driven scheme.
Wow!
Yeah. This is Moneyball for college basketball. Kyle Smith is bringing
it. What is the analytically driven?
So they never give up any threes. They're number 25.
Can we hire Kyle Smith too?
I mean, look, the UW zone. They got it unlocked. That's not a concern.
Still.
Number 25 in terms of opponent three-point attempt
rate. They're not going to appreciate this in Pullman, I assure you.
They never turn the ball over. We're number 15 in the country in lowest turnover rate. Number 45 in two-point percentage, and they had so therefore had the NCAA's 44th best offense this season.
Wow.
So, you know, whether that'll necessarily translate, and it's probably going to take some time, but I think all things considered, this is a lot more inspired hire than hoping that Ernie Kent can have the same success recruiting in Pullman that he did in Eugene with Nike as his sponsor.
So you're saying Kyle Smith would have been a friend of the pod?
May still. Can't rule that out.
He was at Columbia before he was the head coach of USF.
That sounds right, yeah.
He doesn't quite look like what I was expecting. I was imagining him to be quite young.
Yeah, I don't know that much about his background.
Well, I guess good for Wazoo. Taking a chance.
Yeah. All right. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.